For today, we're doing the Satta Surya Sutta, aka the most terrifying sutta in the whole of the Pali Canon. The Seven Suns. In case you thought you were going to have a nice, peaceful sleep tonight after the sutta class, wake up in the middle of the night screaming as the sun's burning the flesh off your bones. That's the kind of effect that we want to get by reading the Buddha's words. All right. Have you had a chance to read it before the thing? No. Okay. So we'll start by reading through the sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Vaisali at Ambapali's Grove. And there the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Ambapali, of course, being the courtesan of Vaisali, who was known for being the most expensive hooker in the land. But you can't really use the word hooker for her because she was very, very high class. So she's like a geisha or something like that. And she was very rich and a very rich and wealthy independent woman. And eventually she donated her mango grove to the Buddha. The Buddha sometimes stayed there even before she donated it, so it's not clear whether this is before or after that happened. Anyway, on one occasion, the Blessed One, later in her life, she went forth and became a bhikkhuni, and she has some of the most powerful verses in the Terigata, actually her verses also dealing with impermanence, as this sutta is. So there the Buddha addressed those bhikkhus. Bhikkhus! So this is something that actually we've just been having a little bit of conversation on. I'm not sure whether I should keep interrupting this or just read through the sutta, but anyway, I'll keep interrupting for now. Why not? I just had a very good cup of coffee, so probably not gonna, the attempt to stop is not going to work. Anyway, because we actually just had some conversation on this on the email, and a number of the monks were having polite differences of opinion on the right way to do translation and things like that. And one of the reason for having this discussion was because of this particular word, bhikkhus, and the way that it's used in the Buddhist scriptures. And actually, you know, you find this word bhikkhus is used very, very often throughout the scriptures, like almost all the time the Buddha's saying, you know, such and such monks and oh monks and so on. And even you might think that there's a lot in the translations, but actually there's a lot skipped out in the translations, right? So it's actually used almost like every paragraph. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi actually leaves it out a lot of the time. But one of the things that's been noticed about it is that this is the way it's used is very idiomatic in Pali. And there's a number of contexts that show that the word monks is used when not just monks were present, but also monks, nuns, laymen and laywomen were present. Okay, so it's even though it sounds like it's just addressed to the monks, but actually it's not. And this is actually a kind of an accepted idiom in the Pali canon. And there are other cases of this as well. For example, when the Buddha's talking to Sariputta and Moggallana, for example, then he addresses it to Sariputta. Okay, so he just addresses it to the most senior, even though he's actually talking to both of them. Or similarly, when he's talking to Venerable Anuruddha and his friends, Kimbila and Nandiya, he just refers to Anuruddha in the plural when talking to his three friends. So this is a kind of idiom that they use. So when we read the word monks here, or bhikkhus, then that doesn't mean to imply that there were only bhikkhus present, but just that it was the convention that was used at the time. So then, of course, it becomes a question, how should you translate it, right? Do you translate it as bhikkhus, in which case it sounds like there's only monks present? Or Venerable Ananda Jodhi said you should translate it as monastics. But then it's also true that sometimes there were lay people present. So do you just translate it as people, right? But there may be, well, non-humans there as well, right? So even a simple thing like that, it seems very obvious, right? Actually, it's not easy to get all the nuance of it right. Anyway, the bhikkhus, Badante, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Conditioned phenomena are unstable. Conditioned phenomena are unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Okay? So this is a very standard passage on impermanence. And this morning we did a service in this very place for a family who just lost their son. 18-year-old son died unexpectedly in a tragic accident. And so this thing about impermanence, it really hits home. And, you know, sometimes when we're meditating or something like that, then we're told like impermanence is like, you know, your feelings, you have a feeling and then it goes away, or you have a thought and then it goes away, and that's impermanence, right? And but actually, if you look at the way the Buddha treats impermanence, it's a lot more hard-hitting than that, actually. It's a lot more, it's not just, oh yeah, well, I had a thought and now it's gone. I mean, that's a kind of a training ground. That's one kind of impermanence. But there are other kinds of impermanence which are very, very challenging to deal with. And in particular, this sutta is dealing with one of the most challenging kinds of impermanence at all. The term here, conditioned phenomena. Actually, I didn't get a chance to check the Pali before this. I probably should have done. The conditioned phenomena, I guess, is sankharas. Okay, so everything which is conditioned. Remembering that the word sankhara, we use in Buddhism as a philosophical term, actually it means something like energies. So in Buddhism, the whole world is made up of energies, sankharas. Okay? Sankharas are impermanent, unstable, unreliable. It is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena. So this word disenchanted is another one which is a little bit of a controversial translation. I think it's probably rendering Pali Nibbida. This is probably a reversion for Bhikkhu Bodhi to translate Nibbida as disenchanted. I think in Majjhima it was disenchanted, and then in Sanyutta he was repulsed or something. Revulsion. And then here he's gone back to disenchantment.
Yeah, people complained to him, it was too strong. Yeah.
Ah.
And they were put off by the sutras.
Okay. Oh, that's not a bad idea. Yeah, go on. And so Venerable will come back. Venerable, for those of you who don't know, Venerable Brahmali was one of Ajahn Bhikkhu Bodhi's main interlocutors in doing the translation of the Anguttara Nikaya. So he read through the whole thing in draft and argued with Bhikkhu Bodhi extensively on multiple points of translation and so on. And so in this particular case, the word we're translating here is Nibbida. And there's one passage. And after Bhikkhu Bodhi published his Majjhima Nikaya, I think it was Ajahn Brahm actually wrote to him and pointed out the word Nibbida is used in a context where it gives a simile and it says, just as if a young man or woman who was very beautiful and fond of their appearance and, you know, liked to look at themselves in the mirror and admire their beauty and so on, and somebody was to come up and place around their neck the rotting corpse of a dead dog, okay, they would feel Nibbida for that, right? So disenchantment is really a little bit weak for that particular context, isn't it? I feel disenchanted with that dead dog that's being hung around my neck, right? So in that context, you have to say something like revulsion, yeah? And so it's actually you'd be, and wanted to push it away as quickly as you can. And so for that reason, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, he translated Nibbida as revulsion. And then later on, then people saying, oh, no, that's too strong. And so now, now he's translating it as disenchantment again. In the Pali context, it's not always with such a strong meaning as that example I just gave. So it's not a black and white case. There was another case I translated a verse some time ago. I'm just trying to remember what the context was now. But anyway, there was another verse, and you could see in that case actually disenchantment was a much better translation. So not as if it's a black and white issue. Okay, so then the Buddha. So this is the basic doctrinal statement. So he's giving this as a teaching on impermanence, and then goes on to give the series of examples to illustrate that. Now, of course, in the suttas, when we talk about impermanence, it's talked about from multiple different angles. Okay, so sometimes the Buddha talks about how the mind arises and passes away so quickly we can hardly even see it. In other cases, he talks about a human life as being impermanent, and so on. So, like every, it's like a fractal phenomena, right? Impermanence happens at the tiniest levels. Every level that you look at, impermanence is happening. And in this case, he's looking at the big picture of impermanence. Okay, because Sineru, the king of mountains, is 84,000 yojanas in length. And thank you very much. So is that Sankara's? Yeah. Right, so Sineru, king of mountains, is 84,000 yojanas in length, 84,000 yojanas in width. It is submerged, 84,000 yojanas in the great ocean, and rises up 84,000 yojanas above the great ocean. So a yojana, for those of you who don't know, is a measure of length in ancient India, equivalent to, the word is related to the word yoke, and it's the length that a team of, usually I think a team of horses would drive without having to change the team over. And it's, I think, usually calculated about 7 kilometres, is that about right? About 12 sometimes? 12 or 16, is it? I thought it was 7. Okay, maybe it's, okay, 12 or 16. So about 12 or 16 kilometres. There's an equivalent in Finnish. Which Venerable Brahmali knows about. And the length of distance they use in Finnish is a reindeer's piss. Okay? So it's like how long you can drive your reindeer before they need to stop and have a leak. Right? So that's how they measure distance in Finland. True story. I'm not allowed to make things up. I'm a monk. So the yojanas. So 84,000 yojanas. So say multiply by 10, 840,000 kilometers, something like that. So say 100,000. Kilometers. Or maybe it was 7 miles, I was thinking. That was probably 7 miles. Yeah, so about 12 kilometers. So roughly 100,000 kilometers. So according to this, there's a mountain which is 100,000 kilometers high. That's a very, very high mountain. You might think that the Darling Ranges are very high. That is, if you've never been to anywhere apart from Perth. But they're not nearly 100,000 kilometres. They're not even 1 kilometre. How high is the Himalayan mountains? 9 kilometres high. About 9 kilometres high. So we're talking 10... My God, that's very high. 10,000 times as high how wide is the Earth? How big is the Earth? 12,000. So the Earth is 12,000 kilometres. So we have the Earth, which is like this, and Mount Meru, which is like that, or Sineru, which is like that on the Earth, something like that. Needless to say, despite years of research and exploration, we haven't yet found Mount Sineru. And you cannot locate it on Google Maps. And one is led to suspect that this was perhaps a mythical mountain. So actually, it's either there's Mount Sineru and Mount Meru, which are referred to very frequently in the Buddhist mythology and cosmology, and it's like the kind of the center of the universe. It's very kind of easy to think, imagine how they would have conceived this. Like if you were down in India and you're sort of looking up, and then you can see the Himalayas sort of receding off into the distance and getting higher and higher and higher, and you sort of imagine that there must be a mountain in the center of all that, which is so incredibly high. And so this is a sort of use of hyperbolic language to describe the highest mountain in the world. Sometimes Mount Meru or Mount Sineru is equated with what we know today of as Mount Kailash in the Himalayan mountains, and that's a sort of great object of pilgrimage for the Tibetan people especially. But actually is like a mythical mountain. It's actually from the same mythos ultimately, because the Indian mythos is from the same roots as the Greek mythos. And so Mount Sineru is equivalent to Mount Olympus in the Greek mythos. And so the gods and so on were supposed to live on the sides of Mount Sineru and things like that.
Some people have high
Yeah. Okay, so the argument is that it's not found in the human realm but found in some heavenly realms. Well, it doesn't sound like it. I mean, normally isn't it, they say that the heavenly realms are on the slopes of Mount Meru or Mount Sinai. Yeah. So I think that's probably a bit of it's what they call retcon. Retcon, retrospective continuity. You know, fix it into place afterwards. So anyway, so huge mountain. So there comes a time, bhikkhus, when rain does not fall for many years, for many hundreds of years, for many thousands of years, for many hundreds of thousands of years. When rain does not fall, seed life and vegetation, medicinal plants, grasses, and giant trees of the forest wither and dry up and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. This is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, to become dispassionate towards them, enough to become liberated from them. Okay, so here the connection between Mount Sinai and the rain not falling is not obvious in this particular passage. And in fact, Mount Sinai is sort of, it's introduced here, but it makes a reappearance later on towards the end of the story. So, a drought. I probably, hopefully, don't need to tell you or remind you that we've experienced droughts, very bad droughts in the recent years. And the drought in California is now the worst drought for 1,200 years. Yeah, they just had a huge storm there, so there's kind of going between extremes. But they had the worst drought in 1,200 years. Yeah? And, of course, Australia has suffered multiple times over the last few years with droughts. Even recently, I was just came back from Malaysia, and Malaysia is the last place you imagine having a drought. And the last place in Malaysia that you imagine having a drought is a place called Taiping. And I was talking about it with my mum just now. She lived in Malaysia for a year, and she said, you know, this is, you drive through, when you're driving along the road from Penang to Ipoh or KL, and, you know, it's like, oh, it's raining, so it must be Taiping. And the clouds will come off the ocean, and they hit the mountains, and they just dump it there. It's unbelievable. When we drove down from Penang to Taiping just a couple of weeks ago, you're just driving, it's just a normal day, right? And you drive along the road, and then you look, and there's this purple, inky, black layer of clouds and lightning and thunder and the unbelievable torrential rain coming down on Taiping. It's just like that every day. And they had a drought, right? Taiping had a drought and water restrictions. Can you imagine? They had water restrictions last year. KL also had very, very bad water restrictions. So this was, my mum said that driving around Malaysia at the time was like driving around Perth in midsummer. Malaysia is not supposed to look like Perth in midsummer. Yeah. Perth is supposed to look like that. Yeah. Malaysia isn't. Yeah. So this is the Buddha's talking about the ecosystem, the environment being impermanent. So, okay, there are, you know, in a sense, there are mythological elements in this sutta, right? And later on we'll talk about all the suns and the Mount Sinai and so on. So some of the context is this kind of bit of a cosmological myth. But the reality in terms of the environment and so on is very much real. That's very much what's happening. And as our climate change accelerates, and as our beloved leaders in Lima continue to argue with each other about who gets to destroy the most of the environment while paying the least, then one wonders whether this situation of having droughts lasting for tens or hundreds or thousands of years is not something that we're going to be facing in the very near future. There comes a time when, after a long time, a second sun appears. With the appearance of the second sun, the small rivers and lakes dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. This is enough to become disenchanted with all conditioned phenomena, to become dispassionate towards them, enough to become liberated from them. So this idea of a second sun appearing in the sky. Well, astrologically, I don't think it's likely that you're actually going to get a second sun appearing. I mean, you might, I don't know how you would, but seems to suggest it's a kind of geocentric view of the universe, that the sun's revolving around the earth, it seems to suggest to me, but maybe not definitively. But the idea is that to me, I take it not necessarily as being literal appearance of suns, but the sun's becoming more fierce, or the weather's becoming more fierce, or something like that. Anyway, but that's open to interpretation, how you want to read that with the second sun. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Now we know astronomically, we know that the eyes are both binary solar
systems.
Right. But actually are two suns, you know, and the kind of the planets revolving around those suns at the same time.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether they are kind of trinary solar systems. I'm not sure about that, but I think they might be trinary as well. But
probably.
This idea should actually exist is quite
right.
Remarkable.
And he'd never even seen Star Wars. Right? Probably not. Well, if he's omniscient, maybe he had seen it. Yeah. Anyway, so yes, this idea, you know, that, but you know, how radical and how powerful the idea of impermanence is, right? And you know, it's like you're in that Indian environment where everything's always about eternity, right? And all the kind of religious myths and so on about how everything's the same and everything repeats and so on and so forth. And yet he's pointing out actually that these things will just change, even those things we take to be the most fundamental and most reliable, right? I mean, there's nothing more reliable than that, yeah? The sun comes up in the morning, there it is, yeah? But even that can change. Any, please feel free to interrupt or ask questions or whatever while we're going on. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And that's what it talks about a bit later on in the sutta. Yeah. But yes, you know, suns change, right? They turn into red dwarfs and supernovas and all kinds of things. Yeah. John. Oh, okay. Great minds. Very good. Okay. Then, after a long time, how long is a long time? Well, who knows? A third sun appears with the appearance of, I should mention also with the rivers, small rivers and lakes drying up and evaporate and no longer exist. Perhaps not as dramatic in the Australian context as it is in the Indian context, I don't know. But anyway, we kind of get used to the idea of having lakes and rivers and things that don't exist. Okay, after a long time, the third sun appears, and then the great rivers, the Ganges, Yamuna, Atiravati, Sarabhu, and Mahi, and dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So permanent are conditioned phenomenon. This is enough to be liberated from them. There comes a time when, after a long time, a fourth sun appears. With the appearance of the fourth sun, the great lakes from which those great rivers originate, the Anotata, Sihapapata, Ratakara, Kannamunda, Kunala, Chaddanta, and Mandakini dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. So these lakes are, as far as I'm aware, all mythical lakes. The Anotata is one which is known in Buddhist sort of mythological literature. There's a number of sort of fabulous discourses which are set on the Anotata lake. Sihapapata, where it's the lion's cliff. I'm not sure where that's supposed to be. Ratakara is a curious name for a lake. It means the chariot maker. Why they call a great lake the chariot maker, I'm not quite sure. Kannamunda, shaven-eared. Is that right? Kannamunda? Yeah, shaven-eared. The shaven-eared lake. Maybe it looks like an ear. Maybe, I don't know. Kunala. Anyway. So the idea is that in the Himalayan mountains there are great mythical lakes, and these are the sources of the great rivers. So again, even though there's a kind of mythological or cosmological context here, then of course in real life, this is in fact what's happening to these rivers and the great rivers that flow from the Himalayan regions, the Ganges and Yamuna, but also the Brahma, what's the one on the east? Brahma something? Brahmaputra, yeah, exactly, thank you. Mekong River. And in China, I think the Yellow River, is it the Yellow River in China? Yeah. And so these rivers are all greatly threatened by development in Tibet and the damming and so on. And of course, these rivers are the rivers on which hundreds of millions of people depend, right, for their water and for their livelihood and for the sustenance of their soil and their land and all kinds of things. And these, you know, these, if you look back in history and you look at great civilizations like the Indus Valley civilization in India and other civilizations, they become established dependent on the waters from some of these great rivers. And then climate change happens, the rivers shift because of earthquakes or tectonic shifts or whatever it might be, and then the civilizations collapse. Yeah, that's the end of them. And we're looking in our life at these great changes which are happening to these rivers. I lived for a number of years, actually 3 range retreats I spent in Thailand on the Mekong River, and staying in kutis on cliffs, which was actually overlooking the Mekong River there. And the Mekong River is a very extraordinary river because out of all of these, it's the wildest and most untamed river. It's almost completely unnavigable for much of its length. And when you kind of look down on it, it's very kind of deep and narrow, and it's fast moving, very incredibly dangerous. And during the time that I was there, there were multiple. This is the most remote, one of the most remote places in Thailand, actually, right on the easternmost tip of Thailand. And during the time I was there, there were multiple proposals for dams and hydroelectric schemes and all of these kinds of things to be built in that very obscure place, which was in fact a national park. And none of those plans went ahead, as far as I know, but it does give you an idea of how much these rivers are under threat. And it's not just in one place or another, and it's not just one project or another, but it's everywhere, all places, all rivers, all countries, all the time that these rivers are under threat. And that makes a huge difference in terms of, you know, these feed the most densely populated parts of the world. So, third son, fourth son. Okay, then there comes a time when, after a long time, a fifth son appears. With the appearance of the fifth son, the waters in the great ocean sink by 100 yojanas, 200 yojanas, 300 yojanas, 700 yojanas. The water left in the great ocean stands at the height of 7 palm trees, 6 palm trees, 5 palm trees, 4 palm trees, 3, 2, or even 1 palm tree, 7 fathoms, fathom probably being a hatapasa, would that be right? Like a half arm's length? 4 fathoms, 3, 2, 1, half a fathom, up to the waist, up to the knees, up to the ankles. Just as in the autumn when thick drops of rain are pouring down, the waters stand in the hoof prints of cattle here and there, so that the waters left in the great ocean will stand there, stand here and there in pools, the size of the hoof prints of cattle. With the appearance of the fifth sun, the water left in the great ocean is not enough even to reach the joints of one's fingers. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, this is enough to be liberated from them. So this is the disappearance of the oceans. Now, if you look in the suttas and in the Indian idioms, the things that are being used here, like the Ganges River and the Mount Sineru and the great oceans, and these are always used as similes for something which is immeasurable, right? So it'd be this is as mighty as the great mountain, or as vast as the great river, or as immeasurable as the great ocean. And these are what you use to convey a sense of something which is so incredibly vast and so huge. And here the Buddha is saying even these things, the biggest, most vast, most abundant things that we know of, even these things will disappear. And of course, just as with all the other things, we are seeing exactly that today. Even though we you know, we can drive from here a few minutes to the west, and we can look out over the great ocean, and you look out over that, and it looks just the same. You know, it looks just the same as it did to me when I was growing up in Perth. You know, nothing's changed. And it seems like we can kind of dump all of our crap in the ocean, and we can throw our sewage in there, and we can put our industrial waste in there, and we can dump our plastic in there. Recent estimates, they now think that there are 1 trillion pieces of plastic rubbish floating around in the oceans. That's 1 trillion. Yeah, 1 trillion is a big, big number. Yeah, 1 trillion pieces of plastic floating around in the oceans, all of them dangerous, all of them killing life. And as well as those 1 trillion pieces of plastic, there's also the heating up of the oceans we're having now. Yeah, what's the figure? I think is it 20,000, equivalent to 20,000 Hiroshima bombs every second. That's the amount of heat that's going into the oceans. I think that's the figure. Someone correct me if I'm wrong there. 20,000 Hiroshima bombs every second. Okay, that's the amount of heat energy that the oceans are being heated up by. And in addition to that, then the acidification of the oceans and also the overfishing. So that everywhere around the world, all of the big fish have been taken out, and commercial fisheries are continually being depleted. And the amount of the stock of fish that are left is very, very small. And so these things all have kind of multiple impacts and multiple, they feed back on each other and amplify each other. So in fact, the oceans largely these days are being taken over by jellyfish. This is one thing that nobody was really predicting, but this is what we're looking forward to, is the jellyfish apocalypse. What do you call it? The jellyfocalypse? I don't know, there's got to be some name for it. And of course, even though here it's talking about the diminishing of the oceans and the ending of them, but of course, in the short term anyway, we're looking at the rising of the oceans. By the oceans are rising both because of the melting of the ice, especially in Greenland and Antarctica, but also because of the expansion of the water due to the fact that it's heating up. And so, of course, as water heats up, it expands. And so the oceans are rising. Conservatively, they say that by the end of the century, the oceans will be risen by 1 meter. And at 1 meter ocean rise, for example, 17% of Bangladesh will be underwater. Okay? That's the densely populated 17%, by the way. Yeah. So that's, 100 million people or something? They've got to go somewhere. Yeah. Of course, the Mekong Valley will also be flooded, so they've got to go somewhere. Christmas Island, perhaps. So these are the challenges that we're going to be facing in coming generations. But that 1 meter sea level rise is extremely conservative. More realistic predictions, probably 2 meter sea level rise, maybe more. Depending on the rate of collapse of the Greenland ice sheet, we could be looking at even up to 10, 15 meter sea level rise in the longer term, although that will take some time to come. So this ocean that we take for granted, right, which is seems so permanent and so stable and so vast, and yet it too is changing. And we can't just predict that things will be the same in the future as they were in the past. And just as this particular sutta is talking about a kind of a long-term shift and change in the climate towards a climate which is much less hospitable for human life. Right? And this is what we're seeing in our own time, a long-term drastic shift in our climate towards something which is much less hospitable to human life, much less fun. When there are 5 suns in the sky, you won't be able to go sunbathing down at Scarborough Beach for very long, even with a maximum protection sunscreen. Okay, then it goes on to the 6th sun. There comes a time when, after a long time, a sixth sun appears. With the appearance of the sixth sun, this great earth and Sinera, the king of mountains, smoke, fume, and smolder. Just as a potter's fire, when kindled, first smokes, fumes, and smolders, so with the appearance of the sixth sun, this great earth and Sinera, the king of mountains, smoke, fume, and smolder. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena. And there comes a time when, after a long time, a seventh sun appears. With the appearance of the seventh sun, this great earth and Sinera, the king of mountains, burst into flames, blaze up brightly, and become one mass of flame. As the great earth and Sinera are blazing and burning, the flame cast up by the wind rises even to the Brahma world. As Sinera is blazing and burning, as it is undergoing destruction, and being overcome by a great mass of heat, mountain peaks of 100 yojanas disintegrate, of 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 yojanas disintegrate. When this great earth and Sinera, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning, neither ashes nor soot are seen. Just as when ghee or oil are blazing and burning, neither ashes nor soot are seen, so it is when this great earth and Sinera, the king of mountains, are blazing and burning. So impermanent are conditioned phenomena, so unstable, so unreliable. It's enough to become disenchanted. It's enough to become dispassionate, to become freed from these conditioned phenomena. So that's pretty dramatic, isn't it? Everything we hold dear, all of the things we think are so wonderful, nature, human accomplishments, cities, technology, all the things we're so proud of, all our lives, everything we think is going to last, all going to burn up. It's not even going to become ashes. Right? No soot or ashes is left behind. And this does, in fact, sound very similar to what happens in a solar system when the sun turns into a red giant or a supernova or something like that, depending how the future, how it evolves. And everything goes. Are you feeling depressed yet? You should be. It's depressing. It's all right. Because it's naturally. We cannot stop that, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's true, right? But when I hear people saying that, then I think either that person is either very wise or they're in denial. Okay, so you have to think for yourself which one. Well, then you see what happens. For example, if you can say it like that, okay, that sounds good. Then what happens if the person who you love the most, what happens if they die? Oh. Oh, I know, yeah. Yeah. Something like that, yeah. And it really does make a difference, right? It's not something which is it's not just a theory or something like that, but if you do contemplate it regularly and do keep this teaching on impermanence in mind, it really makes a difference when it counts, yeah? But the only thing I just think that, you know, I think it's important for people to, you know, just to acknowledge the fact that, well, you know, it's still okay to feel that grief. It's still okay if you hear things like this to be disturbed or depressed. It's okay to be worried about the future, right? But you reflect on it, and when you understand it in terms of impermanence, and then you can learn to accept the future, and you'll worry about it gradually. You know, you come to accept that, and that will come to diminish, and it will come to be okay. Okay. So thinking about it in terms of impermanence is giving us a context and a framework that lets us bring these things to mind. Let's just think about them. Because often they're just too hard to think about, aren't they? We don't like to think about things that are too challenging and too disturbing. Yeah? And, you know, we always, everything has to be sort of framed in the kind of positive way and these kinds of things. I remember seeing many years ago there was a sort of like a satire of these things, and these people did like this kind of song that was supposed to be about let's all focus on the positive with regard to cigarette smoking. And they said, you know, one of the things was like somebody dies every 7 seconds from smoking cigarettes. So, you know, don't be so negative. Let's focus on the 6 seconds in between. Right? It's the power of positive thinking, yeah? Or the power of denial, depending on which way you look at it, yeah? So it's okay, you know, to bring these things to mind and to feel, right? And to feel that, that's so stressful, that's so worrying, okay? But also, you know, you just reflect, that feeling too is impermanent, right? Your response to it is impermanent. You might go home tonight and be very worried about it and thinking, what are we going to do? How are we going to change things? And then you wake up tomorrow morning, maybe you're thinking, it's okay. And you come to a sense of acceptance. So, you know, there's a process to be gone through there. Right? So we have to go through that process. So don't be too quick to dismiss it. Sometimes if you're too quick to dismiss it and say, yes, it's impermanent. Oh, yes, it doesn't matter. Oh, yes, it's, you know. But actually, you're not really facing up to it. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So how do you kind of make sure it becomes wisdom rather than just getting used to that?
Right, yeah. So sometimes you just get kind of bored with it. It just gets in the background and you. Well, you always have to find new ways to sort of make it fresh. This is the thing with Dhamma teachings. I think any kind of teaching that they become worn out, right? After you say they're very fresh when you first hear them, and then they get worn out. You know, like if you look at, say, the Buddha's first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, when they heard that, you know, the group of five monks, you know, they, you know, and Anyukandanya becomes a stream enterer, and it was just like had this incredibly powerful impact, right? But these days we hear that, and it's like, it's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and it's just, you know, it's just another kind of boring teaching on the Four Noble. We know about that, and, you know, what's the big deal? And so you heard it so many times that it just becomes, it's nothing special. But at that time, it was incredibly radical. It's incredibly powerful teaching. And so, yes, we always need to make them real again. Yeah? And so I guess one of the most important ways of doing that is through meditation, where you bring these teachings of impermanence in and you investigate them in your own mind and your own life and with those things, especially those things that are bringing you suffering. So on Friday, my mum bought a new car, and she was very proud. She got a shiny new Mercedes. And so she said, she took it for the first drive through, and she was driving through King's Park, and she was so happy and stuff. And then she noticed that the gum trees were dropping the gum nuts down, and she's like, I've got to go home now. I can't risk getting my car dented. And I said, you know, it's all impermanent, right? Sorry, Emma. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yep, good question. So what happens when the earth burns up? Everywhere, all the sentient beings, not just the human beings, but also all of the other beings, they have to get reborn somewhere. And obviously it's not going to be very hospitable to get reborn on this world. So where do they go? In the suttas do give an answer to that question, but it's not an entirely satisfactory answer. The suttas say that for the most part, beings get reborn in the Abhasara Brahma realm. Okay, so it's a very high, kind of high realm, normally produced by a second jhana. And it says yebhuyena, that beings for the most part. And so I'm not quite sure what the implications are. Does it mean that all beings or most beings have actually practiced second jhana at some point in the past that will get them reborn in there? Seems a bit unlikely, but then maybe a long time in samsara, so maybe we all have done second jhana sometime in the past. On the other hand, does it mean that there's like a special exemption that you can sort of get a pass through the gate without doing second jhana at that time? In which case, all the people who were in there having done all this diligent meditation for many years are like, oh, come on, we did all this work to get here, and then these guys are just... So, not sure, but anyway, the general idea is that, yes, in you get reborn somewhere else, maybe on other planets or something like that, but then you also have like a big crunch, don't you, when all of the planets and so on disappear. So at the end of the whole universe, then it's going to be an even tighter squeeze. Yeah. Right.
So it doesn't use the word rebirth, it uses the word evolving into the Amasra world. Evolves to the Amasra world. Which makes me wonder whether actually something else is meant than rebirth. What's actually going on there?
Oh, I didn't notice that. Okay, somewhat tanti, huh? Okay, Ajahn Brahmali was saying that in that particular context where it talks about beings going to the Abhasa or Brahma realm, it uses a different word than the normal word to use to be reborn, which would be something like upapajati or something like that. But here they use the word sangvatanti, which literally means to evolve. And it's actually used of the universe as a whole, like the evolution and devolution of the world. Sangvatanti, there's also the sangvatanika vijnana, is a consciousness which evolves from one life to the next. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Anyway, it's not an entirely satisfactory answer, but I think the basic principle should be that you're going to get reborn somewhere else. Until conditions are right. Yeah, Wayne. Right. Yeah, well, that beings to be reborn is what they call the antarabhava, and that's it's like an in-between state, and that's, yes, mentioned in the Metta Sutta and quite a few times in the Nidana Samyutta as well. And, so that seems like it's a state of potential rather than a state of actualized rebirth. In that kind of state, you still have five khandhas, right? So you still have five aggregates. It's not an immaterial state, but you don't have like a physical body as such, but you still have there's some physical aspect to what's happening, maybe like an energy or something. So that may be another possibility. Yes, perhaps you're in some kind of almost like suspended animation, or you're stuck in transit for the period of time, right? This is what it is. It's like you're just stuck in the airport lounge and can't move on, until finally they say you can go. Yeah. Kind of terrifying thought, sorry. No, it says that the great earth disappears. There's not even ash left behind. It's all gone. Everyone's nibbanas, yeah. Well, interestingly enough, it does use a similar description. It uses a similar description of somebody who attains parinibbana, right? So there's a few cases in the suttas where monks are about to die, and they realize that they're about to die. And the coolest way to die, if you're a monk, okay? So the most awesome of all ways to die is you get all of the sangha together, and then you sit in the middle of sangha, you fly into the air, and then you burst into flame and burn up, right? So that there's nothing left behind. Now that is a truly awesome way to go. Yeah. And so when it gives that kind of thing, that it says that there wasn't even any soot or ashes left behind, the same kind of idea that there's like completely no residue. Yeah. I've never heard of anyone actually doing that, but there was a case in Bodh Gaya a few years ago when I was there, where a nun actually spontaneously combusted while sitting in meditation in Bodh Gaya. I arrived about a week or two after this had happened, and it was already kind of buzz. Everyone was talking about it, and she was an elderly Bhutanese nun who'd come, and she was just sitting meditation around the Bodhi tree and then just burst into flame, right, and just combusted right there. And everyone, the police were investigating and so on. There was no petrol there. There was no matches. There was nothing flammable. And she just sat there perfectly peacefully and then just burnt up. Okay, don't get any ideas, sisters. Sorry. Sorry, we had a question earlier. Where was the question earlier? Oh, sorry, yes, I'll come back to you on that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, there's one, like I said, there's one or two cases where it says that. Whether it's true or not, I can't say. I've never heard any living examples of people actually doing that. Yeah.
And there was afraid that they were going to be his relatives or people were going to fight over his ashes.
Right. Yeah. So that's even more cool. But having said all of that, remember that when the Buddha himself died, then they had an ordinary funeral pyre with like wood and things like that to burn his body. So, just saying. All right. Sorry, Gabriel. Okay. Vijja. Okay, so who burns up? The monks? Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's actually originating with these stories is where you get the practice of self-immolation that we knew of it originally with the Vietnamese monks during the Vietnamese War, and then more recently with the Tibetan monks who are doing self-immolation. And I think that's one of the sources of that idea. Of course, in those stories, it's actually when you reach the end of your life, right? You know that your time has come, you're finished, and then you sort of, through your spiritual power, your psychic power, you just sort of burn your body up, right? So that's very different from sort of burning yourself as a protest or a political act. Okay. Any more questions? No. All right. Okay, because who, except those who have seen the truth, would think or believe that this great earth and Cinere, king of mountains, will burn up, be destroyed, and will no longer exist? Right, so the Buddha's pointing to what an astonishing thing this is to even talk about it. And he goes on to tell another story. In the past, and this is an idiom, sorry? Right.
And whether, I guess the question is whether it is just a story, something that the Buddha has uses for effect, or whether he actually is aware that this actually is what will happen in the future.
Right. Here, right. Do you have any comment on that? Have a look at the Pali, is actually quite interesting of that. Tatra bhikkhave ko manta, right? Ko manta, who would think? Right. Ko sadhata, who would have faith, who would believe? Ayancha patavi sinera cha pabada raja daihisati vinasisati na bhavisanti di. So this great mountain Meru will burn up and won't exist. Anyatra dittapadehi. Anyatra dittapadehi. Unless somebody who... So dittapada would normally refer to a stream enterer. Yeah, so I'm wondering whether that is implied in that case. Dittapato, it's an unusual word, yeah, dittapadehi, someone who's seen the state, something like that, yeah, unusual phrase. Anyway, it goes on to say, bhutapubang, which is a kind of an idiom. In the suttas, you'll find that there are a number of different idioms for introducing stories, okay, and introducing narratives. The most well-known one is the phrase which occurs in theory, in any case, at the beginning of all the suttas, and that's eva me sutang, thus have I heard. Often, eva me sutang is actually omitted from the Pali text, which is a question of abbreviation, and actually in Chinese and other texts it's always included. But in this particular sutta, eva me sutang is omitted, but it's always should be included by default. It's always meant to be included even if it's not stated. And eva me sutang is traditionally held to be the words of Venerable Ananda at the First Council when he was reciting it, and he was supposed to have heard it from the Buddha himself and is relating something that he heard from the Buddha. However, that's not actually what it means. And unfortunately, it's very clear from the Pali text that it does not mean that at all. Actually, Evamesutang is specifically used as an idiom to mean this is something that I'm passing down through the oral tradition. This is something where I was not actually present at these events, but I heard that it was the case. Okay, it's specifically used to indicate that. And there's an example for a case of that where, for example, Venerable Anuruddha is asked by somebody about various orders of devas or something like that, and he describes them, and the person says to him, it seems that Venerable Anuruddha doesn't say, thus have I heard, so it seems you must have seen these devas for yourself. Okay, so clearly that they knew that if you say, thus have I heard, it means you were not actually there. It's something you're passing down as a tradition. So the words Evamesutang aren't the words of Ananda, because he was in fact present to hear at least many of the Buddha's discourses. So this is just the acknowledgement within the tradition that this is something that's being passed down through the oral tradition. There's another idiom that's used to express the fact that you were actually there, and that's Sammukha me Bhagavato Sutang Sammukha Patigahitang, which means in the presence of the Blessed One I heard this, in the presence of the Blessed One I learnt this, or I remembered this. And this is used by Venerable Ananda mostly, maybe by others, to introduce a teaching where he was actually physically present and heard something and is relating what he heard directly from the Buddha. So it's this idiom, in the Blessed One's presence I heard this, and in the Blessed One's presence I learnt this. And in this sutta, we have another little formula which is used to introduce passages, and this is Bhutapubang. It's translated here as in the past. And perhaps justifiable to translate this as once upon a time, okay? Because this particular idiom is always used to introduce sort of vaguely legendary stories of the past. So it's where we're no longer dealing with kind of literal historical events in the time of the Buddha, but we're dealing with some kind of more or less imaginary events of the past. And, for example, all of the Jataka stories are introduced with this phrase, Bhutapubang, once upon a time. So in the past, because there was a teacher named Sunetta, okay, Sunetta, which means pretty eyes, the founder of a spiritual sect who had without lust for sensual pleasures. Okay, so that probably implies that he had jhanas. The teacher Sunetta had many hundreds of disciples to whom he taught a dhamma for the companionship with the Brahma world. Companionship with the Brahma world? You're going up and being, I'm mates with the world? Companionship, Brahma Sahavita? Brahma Loka Sahavita. Yeah. Anyway, I'll move on. I won't complain. Yes, I will. Okay, moving on. When he was teaching, those who understood his teaching completely were, with the breaking up of the body after death, reborn in a good destination in the Brahma realm. But of those who did not understand his teaching completely, some were born in companionship with the devas who control what is created by others, some in companionship with the devas who delight in creation, and Tusita and Yama and Tavatingsa and the four great kings and so on. So these are all the different levels, the heavenly realms, according to the Buddhist cosmology. Some were reborn with the Kshatriyas or the Brahmins or with the affluent householders. So these are again the different fortunate levels of human life. So essentially the point that's being made here is of that person's following, that they all got born in some good destination, right, as far as high as the Brahma realm, or at least into a good human life, which is kind of interesting, because if you think in the Buddha's case, not all of his followers got reborn in a good human life. Some of his followers went to hell. So perhaps Sunetta was a better teacher than the Buddha. I don't know. Anyway, moving on. I'll try not to be too heretical from here on out. Then, because it occurred to the teacher Sunetta, it isn't fitting that I should have exactly the same future destination as my disciples. Let me develop loving kindness further. Then for 7 years, the teacher Sunetta developed the mind of loving kindness. As a consequence, for 7 eons of world dissolution and evolution, he did not come back to this world. When the world was dissolving, he moved on to the realm of streaming radiance. And when the world was evolving, he was reborn in an empty mansion of Brahma. So here we see these words dissolving and evolving, which we mentioned previously, Sangvata and Vivata. There, in that empty mansion of Brahma, he was Brahma, the great Brahma, the vanquisher, the unvanquished, the universal seer, the wielder of mastery. He was, so Brahma, of course, being the great god of the Hindu or Brahmanical tradition, and more or less being equivalent to the creator god in the monotheistic religions, except, of course, for being conditioned and foolish and so on. He was Saka, king of the gods, 36 times. Many hundreds of times he was a wheel-turning monarch, a righteous king who ruled by the Dhamma, a conqueror whose rule extended to the four boundaries, one who had attained stability in the country, who possessed the seven gems. So seven gems are not literal gems, but they're seven, seven attributes that a wheel-turning monarch has, such as the perfect queen, a perfect treasurer, a perfect various kinds of things that they have anyway. So he has over 1,000 sons who were heroes, vigorous, able to crush the armies of their enemies. He reigned after he had conquered this earth as far as its ocean boundaries, not by force and weapons, but by the Dhamma. So this is this idea in the Buddhist text of a wheel-turning monarch. And the details of the mythology of the wheel-turning monarch indicate, it seems to me, that this ideal was derived ultimately from the Brahmanical texts, especially in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which develops the idea of the king who gains his sovereignty by means of the horse sacrifice. And the way that these things are described is quite similar, except, of course, in the Buddhist case, you don't have sacrifice of humans and animals, and you don't have violence. So this is a kind of ideal of a universal ruler. The closest in history to reaching that ideal, of course, was King Ashoka. So in any case, the main purpose of this paragraph is to show that through the power of developing that meditation and developing the jhana based on loving kindness, that he, for a very, very long time, was born into these magnificent, very positive rebirths. Because though he had such a long lifespan and continued on for such a long time, the teacher Sunetta was still not freed from birth, from old age and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish. He was not freed from suffering, I say. For what reason? Because he did not understand and penetrate four things. What four? Noble, virtuous behavior, that's Arya Sila. Noble concentration, noble samadhi, Arya Samadhi. Noble wisdom, Arya Panya. And noble liberation, Arya Vimutti. And then the Buddha goes on, referring to himself. Noble, virtuous behavior has been understood and penetrated. Noble concentration, noble samadhi, has been understood and penetrated. Noble wisdom has been understood and penetrated. Noble liberation has been understood and penetrated. Craving for existence has been cut off. Bhavatanha, the conduit to existence, has been destroyed. The bhavaneti, now there is no more renewed existence. Okay? Can I just ask, I'd like to do a quick survey here. What do you understand by the word existence in that last passage? What does existence mean? Especially when I hear from people who don't know all that much about the suttas. Right? Not so much sutta experts who maybe read the footnotes and stuff like that. People, when you just read that passage, what do you think that existence means? Or when you first read it, something like that, what do you think it means? Or does it not mean anything at all? Being reborn? Being reborn in this plane? Craving for life? Okay. Okay, any other thoughts on that? No more five skandhas? Okay. Okay, any other thoughts on that? No more rebirth at all? Okay. Anyone else? No? Does it mean anything? Does anybody read that and then go, I don't know what that means? How can you not be wanting to exist? When you have this passage, craving for existence has been cut off. conduit to existence has been destroyed. Now there is no more renewed existence. What do you understand by that sentence? When you read that, what do you think it means? Or does existence mean anything to you? How do you understand that passage? What's it trying to say? That's all right. That's right. No bonding. Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's all right. That's right. Yeah. Kind of. But that's fine. I was just interested to hear people's responses. So that's fine. Yeah. Any other suggestions? Any other thoughts? What do you make of it? It's just the reason I'm asking is because I'm not sure whether using the word existence as a translation here is a good way to translate it. And so I'm just wondering, because sometimes when you get used to these things for a very long time, you kind of forget what it actually means to someone in a different context. Like if you're reading it fresh, then it has a different meaning than if you're used to, you're conditioned to understand it from a Buddhist point of view. So I was just wondering if anybody had any other reactions or responses to the term. No? No. All right. Okay. Yeah. You can't understand that. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you understand by that? Bit confused. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the phrase here is a very idiomatic phrase. And the phrase is bhavaneti samuhata, right? So bhavaneti samuhata means destroyed or made an ending of or whatever. But bhavaneti, bhava is, we translate as existence, right? But it actually means like a state of rebirth, right? So you have like the manusa bhava is like the human realm or something like that. So it's actually being, it's almost like a life or something. So you will be born in that life. So the neti literally means a cord. Right, or a lead, or a cord, or a tie, or something like that. So, in one sense, it's fairly it kind of obviously means that your attachment to that existence, right? So you're being tied onto that existence. But it seems to have another and reason. I think why Venerable Bodhi has translated as conduit is it seems to have a slightly more sort of an implication, almost like it's kind of something that leads you to that existence, or almost like pulls you to that existence. And it's an interesting idiom because there's been a number of kind of reports of people who have kind of visions of maybe meditation or something like that, or of, you know, when they're coming to die and they have like a vision of where they're going to reborn or something like that. And they actually sort of see, they almost like see literally a cord of light that connects them from this life to a next. And this is something that actually people do report. And so it's quite an interesting idiom in that respect, right? So it's that tie of life that sort of reaches out in one sense from yourself to where you're going to get reborn. Yeah, you think of it as it's that conduit. You sort of reach out with your mind and you attach a tie onto where you're going to get reborn, and that's what you're going to pull yourself along to go there. Yeah, so this is somehow the idiom. I mean, actually, it just kind of means like craving or something like that, right? So the craving to be reborn. But it seems to me there's something more to the metaphor than just craving. Like there's a reason why that particular metaphor is used. It's almost like you're like reaching out and tying yourself up to the new existence and then pulling yourself along to it. Yeah. I'm not sure about preordained, but. From the karmic perspective, yeah, that you know, I mean, it can still change, right? So, but yeah, it's like you establish that connection first before you actually get reborn. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's like almost like a pipe, or an electric. Almost like you're plugging in the electrical cord that you can then send your consciousness down. Something like that. Not to take it too literally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you can control the rats. Wow. Okay. Thank you. Okay, anyway, we've reached more or less the end of the class and more or less the end of the sutta, so there's just the conclusions. I'll just maybe conclude, Alan, we'll come back to you in just one sec. So this is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Fortunate One, the Teacher, further said this, so the Fortunate One and the Teacher are just other epithets for the Buddha here. Virtuous behavior, so sila, concentration, samadhi, wisdom, panya, and unsurpassed liberation. These things, the illustrious Gotama, okay, the family name of the Buddha, understood by himself. Having directly known these things, the Buddha taught the Dhamma to the bhikkhus, the teacher, the end maker of suffering. The end maker of suffering. I prefer Terminator for that. But that's just because I was a science fiction fan, so I like Terminator. Anyway, the one with vision has attained Nibbana. Okay, so interestingly enough, that the verses are very clearly spoken in a third person there. So this is obviously not the Buddha's voice there, but somebody talking about the Buddha. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of as a sutta, this sutta is in some ways quite unusual. The story of Sunetta and the story of the past is not very common, that kind of story. There's a few other places we have similar ones, but the sutta itself is quite unusual. In many respects, the story about the seven sons, I believe, doesn't occur anywhere else in the suttas, is that right? No. There's various other places where it talks about the evolution, change of the world and so on, but never anywhere where it talks about the seven sons. So quite an unusual sutta in many ways, and I think you'll agree, quite a challenging and powerful one, and a very, very dramatic illustration of the teaching of impermanence. Taken even up to that very sort of vast cosmic scale. So, Alan, yes, you were going to say. Right. Yep. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah, and you're not going to get reborn. Essentially, that's what it means, right? So it basically means I'm not going to get reborn again. And so I was just curious, because I didn't know, because if you know the Pali and you're familiar with the idioms, then it's clear that that's what it means. But often when people read it, they don't actually interpret it in that way. So I was just curious about whether that meaning was actually conveyed by the English or not. Or whether it should be translated more explicitly to just, you know, translate as something, I'm not going to get reborn again or something. Yeah, I mean, that's a more idiomatic translation. Wayne? Becoming is a dreadful translation. There's no more becoming in the future. It's not even English anymore. This is what they call Buddhist hybrid English. This was a hangover from the kind of colonial era of translation. There's various kind of historical reasons for it. But becoming, you should never be used for bhava. One reason being that bhava is a countable noun, whereas becoming is not. If you think about the Ratna Sutta, it says, Nate bhavang atamang adianti, that one does not take up an eighth bhava. Okay, so it's talking about a stream enterer. So a stream enterer only has seven lives left, so they don't take up an eighth bhava. So you can't say it doesn't take up an eighth becoming, right? It doesn't work. But you can say it doesn't take up an eighth existence or an eighth life, perhaps. Yeah, something like that. Actually, life is not a bad translation for bhava also. Yeah, there's no future lives. Yeah. seven things. Uh-huh. Yeah. Why? Between, what makes the difference? Ah, well, I guess how hard you practice, you know, and how well developed your faculties are. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, do you say, oh, now I'm a stream enter, hey, take it easy. Yeah, whoopee, go on holidays, right? No more getting reborn in the hell realms, no more bad rebirth, I can go to heaven seven times, right? Or do you say, no, I need to redouble my efforts and do some meditation. Yeah.
I was just saying that in the there is a sutta which brings up precisely this point that Bandhusiddhartha was saying, that you know, you can sort of chill out and take it easy if you are a stream enter, or you can practice harder. And the Buddha actually makes that specific point in a certain place where he says that he didn't give the teaching about the Saupadisesa Nibbana, which means the Nibbana with remainder, which is like all the other areas. Well, there's different ways, so this term can be understood a different way. But one understanding is that the Nibbana with remainder refers to all the areas, apart from the Arahant, which is the Nibbana without remainder. And he says that the reason I didn't give this teaching before is because I was afraid people were going to kind of, you know, take it easy and not practice hard. That was exactly that point. Yeah. Thanks, Pandit.
So I think we're supposed to finish at 4:15, aren't we? Is that right? Something like that. So we should probably wrap up unless there's any last questions before we finish.
Yes?
We have a last question. Okay. Chanda, sorry. Right. Yeah, three different terms. Okay, thanks for that. So, I wondered that myself. So usually in those kinds of cases, the different terms are actually just synonyms. So, but I also didn't know what the term was. So let me just have a look. Okay. Anicca bhikkhave sankhara. So sankharas, that is energies or conditioned phenomena, are impermanent. Anicca adhuva bhikkhave sankhara. Okay. So sankharas are adhuva. Bhikkhubodhi translates as, what is it? As unstable, aduva, unstable, aduva, impermanent, unstable, not, it really means make kind of not, almost like not consistent or something, doesn't it? Not, yeah, anyway, something like that. Not stable, and anasasika. Oh, that's a kind of unusual word. Anasasika. Nasasika. I don't know what it is. It's quite unusual. It's a bit unusual, isn't it? Okay. Yeah, anyway, quite an unusual, bit of an unusual word there. Okay, so there you go, anasasika sankhara. Mm. No. No, this is a Thai idiom where the word sankhara has come to mean in Thailand that the body. And the reason for that is really just that in the Thai funeral chanting, you always chant anicca vata sankhara. And people think that means that your body is impermanent because it's just what happened is you just died. So you chant anicca vata sankhara. So in Thailand, the kind of idiomatic meaning often is that sankhan means the body. But that's not what it means in Pali at all. Sankhara in Pali means anything which is conditioned. Okay, so your body, your mind, your feelings, anything in the world is all sankhara. Yeah, all sankhara is conditioned. Everything. Yeah, yeah. Actually, that verse, anicca vata sankhara, is not really appropriate to recite at funerals, even though we do it all the time, and even though I did it this morning as a funeral chant, because it's actually talking about parinibbana. And it's recited when the Buddha passed away that all sankharas are impermanent. So it's when the Buddha dies or an arahant dies, then yes, that way you say all conditions are impermanent. And that's why the last verse of the last line of the verse, it says, Deyasang vupasamo sukho, that their passing away is bliss, right? So this is a bit hard to explain that when you're at a funeral or something like that, and you're trying to explain to people actually what this means is that, you know, everyone's got to die, and when you die, we're all really happy. No, that's not quite what it means, right? It means that when someone attains parinibbana and they pass away and all sankharas, yeah, pass away, then desang vupasamo sukho, yeah, they're still in his bliss. Yeah. So, go on. This is another meaning of sankhara. It's another idiomatic meaning. Actually, in generally speaking, in Thai usage, you really have three meanings for it. One is it means the body, the rangai. Another meaning is sankhan means like thoughts, kit prung dang. Yeah? And so that's kind of related to one of the meanings in Pali of sankhara in the five khandhas. Something like that. Not exactly that, but not dissimilar. But there's also a third meaning where it means everything which is conditioned. Okay, so basically everything that isn't nibbana, yeah, is a sankhara. This is like a philosophical meaning. Yeah. So in Pali, actually, has both those last two meanings. It has, but the first meaning, not really. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Yeah, you can. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to get back to this idea where the Buddha talks about the, you know, the sun, the starting with one sun and then getting more and more heat from the sun, and things gradually drying up, and eventually the whole earth being burnt up. And I find it quite stunning, actually. I find it quite amazing, this whole scenario that actually is in the sutta, as the Buddha is talking about this, right? I guess what I'm wondering, it is so close to what actually is happening in astronomy, according to the, you know, future of the universe, according to astronomical calculations or whatever. It's so close that it's almost undistinguishable. The only difference is that instead of seven suns, you have one sun which expands until it swallows up the planet. And I guess what I'm wondering, and I mean, I know you are a bit of expert in mythology and that sort of stuff. Is there any other mythology which has this idea, which is even remotely similar? And if there isn't, then it might point to the fact that the Buddha actually knows this, but possibly by recollecting past universes or something like that. Do you have any response to that?
Yeah. Well, that's right, yeah, and the Western cosmology has always been very limited and very small. Yeah, they are, yeah. With the seven suns appearing and so on, I mean, the reality is that if you look in the mythology for long enough, you pretty much find just about anything, you know, so I'm reluctant to say you don't find it, but I can't think of any examples where it talks about that off the top of my head, but there may well be examples. Yeah, but I mean, more typically, most mythology tends to be talking about the past, though. It tends to be talking about how did this come to be, yeah, rather than what's going to happen in the future. But you do find that as well, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. When? Sure, seal of effect, and sometimes Jupiter could go supernova as well, or go nova, or ignite, or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, we should probably finish up and pay respects to the Triple Gem.